Would you ever even think to cook fowl while it's still alive and then serve it at a dinner party? There was a time when that was not only considered appropriate, but also very classy. I'm Lisa Brault, and today on Focus, we're going to take a look deep into the history of food. I'll talk with William Sitwell. He's a food writer and magazine editor in the UK and is the author of the new book, The History of Food in 100 Recipes. I'll talk with him about a few food pioneers, the first accounts written about cheese, and about how even though ideas about food change over time, there are many things that stay the same. We'll also talk about how he went about researching the book, what sparked the idea, and why he chose 100 recipes to tell about the history of food. That's all coming up on Focus after this news. Good morning and welcome to Focus. I'm Lisa Brault, sitting in for Jim Meadows. Today on the show, I'm talking with William Sitwell. He's the author of a new book called A History of Food in 100 Recipes, out recently on Little Brown, who claim it to be, and I quote, the definitive story of the people, ingredients, and techniques that have shaped our love of food. He's the editor of Waitrose Kitchen magazine over in the UK, as well as Waitrose Food Illustrated, can be seen regularly on food-related TV programs on the BBC Two, and he's written about food for a wide variety of newspapers and magazines. He lives with his family in Northamptonshire, England. This is his first book, and you can find out more information about him in the book at our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. William Sitwell, welcome to Focus.
Great pleasure.
So I think we have to start the conversation with something that I loved reading about in the introduction of your book, which was about an auction that you visited at Sotheby's in London a few years ago. I'd love to hear more about that story and how it was the impetus or part of the impetus for A History of Food in 100 Recipes.
Well, that's right. It was really where the story began for me, and it was the motivation to write the book, because I went to Sotheby's, which is an old auction house in London, and they were selling off a collection, a vast cookbook collection of a New Yorker called Stanley Steiger. And I thought that I should go along and see if there are a few books that I could add to my very, very small collection in my study in the English countryside. And I came away with an armful of about 20 books from the early 19th century, the sort of 1800s. And my first thought was, oh, I've wasted loads of money. These look a bit dusty and dull and boring. And then I started reading them, and what really struck me was the fact that there is nothing new about passionate foodies, obsessives, opinion. The books that I uncovered, there's one by a guy called William Kitchener called The Cook's Oracle, so full of opinion. He attacks every other cookery writer that had lived previously, every other cookbook. He said they were useless and said, at last, I'm going to publish a book that actually works. And I just was fascinated by the fact that there was all this amazing opinion and quite almost aggressive criticism for other cooks and so on. Because what amused me was that as an editor of a magazine, a food magazine, PRs send me the latest cookbook every week, and they tell me this at last is the most definitive thing. This book will work like no other book. And it struck me that over time, nothing's changed. And actually, I went right back as far as 1500. When the first ever cookbook was published. It's called This Book of Cookery. And I got hold of a copy in Longleat, beautiful stately home in the south of England. I had to wear gloves and sit in an air-conditioned room, and I looked through this book. And it begins in old English. It basically says that, at last, here is a book more plainer than any previous book. In other words, here at last is a book that really works. So it struck me that there's been a lot of repetition over the years. People have been saying the same thing about food. And so it kind of set me on a path to find out how recipes have been written over time and what that says about people, what that says about us as humans, how we've eaten, how we interact with food.
There are many academic books about food history, and there are many books about particular foods and their histories, like salt, for example. But your book covers a lot of ground, both in terms of food and a historical timeline. Did you set out to write it just like this, or did it evolve from one thing to another?
Well, it always struck me that I needed to write it chronologically, because I felt that that was the easiest way to understand how the history of food developed. And so what I did as a journalist was find what to me were the most interesting stories, the most interesting characters, the most extraordinary discoveries that basically, move the history of food onwards. And so what I found was that there were these amazing stories. So as a journalist, my sort of tabloid instincts sort of set in, and that's that's really how I was directed. So it may, on the one hand, seem difficult to pinpoint 100 key recipes over time, but actually, in order to cover everything from, let's say, the origins of the modern supermarket to a discovery of amazing ingredients, that actually there were these sort of amazing signposts that I was drawn to as a journalist, and there were stories that I needed to investigate and discover. So the book sort of, you know, wrote itself quite naturally, really. I spent a lot of time in the British Library, an amazing institution in London, where every book that's ever been published, more or less, there is a copy of it. So I sat with a researcher and over a period of 6 months wrote the book and learned a lot myself about history. I realized how ignorant I was myself, really.
So going along with that, how did you whittle down the possibilities to just 100? Why 100? Why not 50 or 200? Or
Well, 100 is a good number. I'll also admit that there's a book called The History of the World and 100 Objects. So I thought, that's good. I'll nick that title. And, you know, unashamedly, I'll steal that, because I think it works quite well for food. And people like a neat number, and it focuses the mind. I mean, you know, let's face it, you could write 1,000, but 100's about just about possible. And I like a good round number. So it seemed a good discipline to produce a number like 100. And it also meant that I could set myself the task of writing 100 essays, which also meant that I could work my, you know, my timetable, my work quite effectively and write. I had to write five essays a week over 6 months. So it was pretty intensive. But nice round, even number.
So this is your first actual book that you've written. Why would you attack this huge subject for your very first book?
Well, yeah, you might say it's crazy, because what can my next book be? I mean, if I've written the whole history of food, it's quite difficult to then go, right, what's next, since I've done it all? Except, of course, it's just my history, and I wouldn't claim it's the definitive history. I talked to a publisher about the idea, and they decided to commission me. So there are lots of ideas that I came across in the course of research that I think that are literally sort of almost throwaway lines that I think could make whole books themselves.
The first half of the book deals largely with recipes or information that has been mostly but not completely lost to history. In this area, in our area in central Illinois, we have one of the top library schools in the country, library graduate schools in the country, so we have many librarians and historians in our listening area. And I would like for you to talk a little bit about the travel you did and the work that you had to do to be able to look at and work with materials, and maybe you can start with your trip to Egypt, since that's the first story in the book.
Well, yeah, I mean, little did I know that I'd be scrabbling up the dusty sides of a hill overlooking Luxor in order to begin my journey. What I wanted to do was to try and find the first depiction of bread being made, which I could then argue was a recipe. And there's an amazing tomb on the hills above the Nile, overlooking what is now Luxor, which used to be called Thebes. And it's a tomb to a woman, which is very rare, because most tombs were to men. And it's a tomb that's very, very well preserved. And in that tomb, there are the very well-preserved, very detailed depictions of what an ancient Egyptian would wish to take into the afterlife, the things that they love from this world. And this woman, whose name was Senet, she was either the wife or the mother, we don't know, of a character called the Antifoka, who was an official who was basically one of the pharaoh's right-hand men. And she obviously loved her food, because there's very clear depictions of butchering going on. There's wonderful depictions of seabirds and fish and so on. And there's also a very clear wall depicting the making of Egyptian flatbread. So I had photographs of that wall sent to my food editor in London, who transcribed it, and very faithfully, so that you can see the process that's been made. The book sort of moves on, and we find there are a whole collection of what's called the Babylonian collection at Yale. These are ancient tablets from Mesopotamia, which is modern-day Iraq, which for many, many hundreds of years, thousands of years, people just thought were rather boring chemical formulae. They were about the same size as a modern, like, Kindle or iPad, and they were written in Arcadian cuneiform, which is a very ancient script. And as I say, for years, people thought these were just boring mathematical equations, until about 10 years ago, someone called Jean Bottero decided to use a new translation technique, and he discovered that one of the tablets wasn't just about mathematics, it was a recipe for meat stew, which I just love. So you know, it must have been an important meat stew to have been written down, because, of course, people were mainly illiterate, And also, recipes written down over time, certainly for the first, you know, 1,000, almost 2,000 years in history that we can delve into, were not for practical use. I mean, the first English cookbook, this book of cookery, as I mentioned earlier, this that I saw a copy of, the first ever printed cookbook. Now, you look at that book, there's no oil stains on, there's no flour. This was not a book for the kitchen. This was a book to celebrate the master cook of a king. So cookbooks were not there for practical reasons for cooks. And actually, recipes were never very helpful. And of course, most cooks were illiterate. So I traveled a bit. The travels I had were really in my mind. I spent a lot of time in the British Library. I didn't have huge budgets to travel around the world. Maybe next time, maybe if I do the TV show on the book, I can go around the world tasting these amazing dishes.
Speaking of that, you mentioned that the recipes are not necessarily written down for use or for anybody to follow. But did you test the recipes as written in the book?
Do you know what? The answer is no. I was too busy writing it. But I have cooked some of them subsequently. I mean, I wasn't trying to produce a book that was a practical guide to cookery. My deliberate intention was not to say this recipe works, tweak that ingredient, here's a recipe, here's a modern translation, you can go down to your local supermarket and then whip it out at home, create the food at home. I wanted to show people exactly how recipes were written down in the past and right up to the present day, and however impractical and however useless that may be. So I didn't test them out, but neither is every chapter, even though I purport to write 100 recipes, they're not all recipes, because there are moments in time that for food are very, very important, but recipes weren't written down to match it. For example, I was trying to pinpoint a moment where we have the earliest depiction of bread in Europe. Now, bread was being cooked, of course, for many centuries, but there weren't any recipes written down until about the 1600s. So I found a detail in the Bayeux Tapestry, very important tapestry that depicts 1066, the Battle of Hastings, etc. And in that, you can see a bit of outdoor catering, some bread being made. So I used that as the starting point to talk about bread. I wanted to talk about the Vikings and their influence when they started marauding over the British Isles and further in 700 AD. The Vikings, when they came to sort of burn down your house and pillage, didn't stop to take down recipes. So I relied on the sagas, these oral traditions passed down over generations that described the various goings on between the Vikings and when they went out and bought loads of fish. I tried to be as honest to the historical moment as possible and use that as a springboard to write about the food of that time and what it says about the people. So they're not all exactly what you might call recipes, but hopefully I'll get away with it.
Well, certainly I think someone working backward, because toward the end of the book, the last third or almost half of the book, I would say, have recipes that resemble recipes that we would use today. So if somebody could work backwards, and as they got better at cooking, maybe they could sort of figure out what the ancient recipes meant. So
that's right. Yeah, I wouldn't want to stop anyone from having a go. Although I sometimes add a cautionary note when I sign a book and I say, don't try all the recipes. And I don't want to be blamed.
So you've touched on a couple of the historical topics and concepts that I actually want to move into now, some of these actual stories. And we don't have enough time, obviously, for all 100 recipes or events. But several did stand out to me, and you've touched on it a little bit, food preservation. And I want to know how the discovery of food preservation changed the way humans cultivated and ate food. And I especially enjoyed your description of the Vikings' use of an olfactory lighthouse, so to speak. Can you relay that story as part of your answer?
Well, yeah, man, woman, over history has had two great issues with food. They've had to be able to get food, and then they've had to be able to preserve it. And it's only relatively recently in our history that we have had access to fridges and so on. So throughout time, it's always been the cook's necessity to preserve food. You know, whether that's making jam, whether it's burying fish, and the key thing was that, you know, you'd have to get your fish, let's say, preserve it, dig it in the ground, and keep it for a time when you could then return to it. And what the Swedes, for example, discovered was that burying their fish actually produced, the kind of what is now regarded as gravel act, the process of preserving fish, digging it, putting it in the ground, actually, and salting it, transformed it to something very, very different and something very, very wonderful. So humans have made these discoveries by the very nature of them trying to preserve food. I mean, today, we have it easy. You know, we don't have to think about that. So we've actually lost a lot of our traditions. We've lost a lot of our, you know, preserving traditions, and less people probably make jam these days because you can just buy it, which is very sad. You know, that we, you know, we might think we're all very modern and lucky, but actually it means that, you know, the process of industrialization, all the modern gadgets that we have in the home, don't allow us to actually involve ourselves in the whole process of food and food preservation.
So the first recipe for bread in the book was from Egypt, and as we mentioned, and further in, you discuss the beginning of the shift in 1066 with the Bayern tapestry that you're talking about, from brown bread to white bread, and what that meant culturally. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, it's very interesting because 1066, people think, as the historians of certainly European history will know, that 1066 was the Battle of Hastings. But what we see after 1066 is mentions of a thing called the hair sieve. And it's very likely that the hair sieve was introduced into English culture by the Normans, the French essentially. And what this enabled people to do was to sift and sieve flour much more finely. And it enabled the cook to produce a loaf that was much finer. Think of a kind of, you know, much fluffier white loaf. And I think you have to see bread as being a status symbol. So a nobleman would brandish his fluffy white loaf in the same way someone today might brandish a new iPhone. It would impress people. But of course, what's interesting is that things have completely been turned on their head now, in that the fashionable foodies don't wish to associate themselves with white bread. They want the peasant bone-crunching stuff filled with seeds with a hard crust. So things have sort of flipped, and we like today what the peasants liked of old. And the social symbol of bread has rather changed dramatically.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, no, that was it.
Okay. One other story that I really enjoyed in terms of the history is about the fork, the introduction of the fork. And you write about a man named Thomas Coriat who traveled throughout Europe in the early 1600s, and he brought back a couple of contraptions that didn't quite take hold right away. One of them was the umbrella, and the other one was the fork, which resulted in his being given the nickname by his friends of, I hope I'm saying it right, Furcifer?
Yeah, that's right. Thomas Coriat is a great hero of mine from food history. No one seems to really know about him. But as you say, he made these two startling discoveries. In 1608, he left the shores of England to travel around Europe so he could write a wonderful book called Coriat's Crudities, in which he details his various escapades around Europe. And he has a day in Italy when he makes, as you say, these two amazing discoveries. He sees an umbrella for the first time. He sees someone walking down the street using an umbrella to shield them from the sun, not incidentally to shield them from any rain. And so when he got back to London, he told his friends about it, and they just laughed at him, saying, oh, this will never catch on. And then he makes a second discovery, which again you mentioned, which is the fork. And he saw these Italian gentlemen using a fork in a tavern. And so he again talked about that to his friends. He wrote about it, and they called him Pitchfork, that old word, Furcifer. They laughed at him. They said, oh, no, there's a fork. This will never catch on. Because the view was that all you needed was a piece of bread and a knife, and then you just shovel the food into your face. And the fork is simply part of social nicety. You don't need a fork to eat. And indeed, it took a couple of hundred years for the fork to become part of mainstream culture. Some people would now say, with the development of fast food culture, the fork is now being relegated. People don't need it anymore because you can just whack a hamburger into your mouth. So I imagine that Thomas Coriat's friends would probably associate themselves with the modern hamburger munchers today, who don't need forks either.
What I found striking about that was even religion even got into the act with a fork. And Martin Luther said, God preserve me from forks.
Yeah, that's right. Because, again, he felt that it took you a stage removed from your food, which was the gift of God. And it was an unnecessary tool.
Something else that struck me was, particularly in the first, I would say, first 30 or so chapters or recipes in the book, was how many of the recipes you wrote about were for huge feasts, serving not hundreds, but thousands of people with often impressive looking, if not very tasty food. When do we start to see a transition to food being prepared for smaller groups?
Well, I suppose it happens probably in the sort of 18th century. But you're quite right. I think the food prepared at a smaller level was obviously going on, but it just wasn't written about. It wasn't recorded. Whereas the big gargantuan feasts, which were given by noblemen, by kings, these were things that were written down. So it's not that these things weren't happening, it's just they weren't recorded. But there is a wonderful feast that I talk about that takes place, given by King Richard II and the Duke of Lancaster, 12th of September, 1387. And in this book, The Form of Curie, which is Curie's old English word for cooking, there's a shopping list detailed for this particular feast. And it reads, 14 oxen lying in salt, 120 carcasses of sheep fresh, 140 pigs, 210 geese, 400 conigs, which were large rabbits, 12 cranes, 11,000 eggs. So, you know, that's a pretty extraordinary shopping list. And then there's a wonderful man called Cheekart Amixo, who was operating in the early 1420s. And he produces one of the most amusing recipes of all time. It's a recipe for something he calls Parma tart. And the recipe simply goes as follows. Take three or four large pigs, 300 pigeons, 200 baby chickens, 100 capons, 600 small birds, mix with spice, put in pastry. It's not the most practical recipe of all time.
So it kind of makes me wonder, when you're talking about this and the size of these feasts, when the people who made the food, who were actually doing the preparing, not overseeing it, but preparing, when they actually ate and what they ate.
Look, the real history of food for most people on this planet is not a very exciting one. You know, the poor basically ate porree, pottage, cabbage, you know, soup put onto bread. Bread used to be called the sop. It's what you put the soup onto. So actually the word for sop comes from bread, and of course, which is kind of interesting. But that's right. I mean, we had a very limited scope of food throughout time, and not just the poor. I mean, what I think is amazing is that one of the most important moments in food history occurs in the early 1500s when the Spanish, in particular the Spanish conquistador Hernan Cortes, marauds his way through what is now Mexico, what he called the New Spain, came across Montezuma, the great Aztec leader. One ancient culture, Montezuma, meeting one modern European culture in the form of Hernan Cortes. And he discovers all these amazing ingredients, and he takes back with him cocoa beans, chocolate beans, coffee beans. He takes back chilies. He brings back tomatoes, potatoes, as well as turkeys, and as well as gold, which transformed the food of Europe. I mean, what's extraordinary is, you think about what we were eating before that. How do you exist without a tomato? And the first recipe for a tomato doesn't get published until 1692. People were rather worried about tomatoes. I mean, as late as the early 1800s, there's a British horticulturalist who was attacking tomatoes, saying that they were poisonous and you should avoid them. And they were, after all, related to the plant deadly nightshade, so that's maybe understandable. And the early tomatoes would probably have been, what people would regard as rather frightening yellow-looking things, which we now look for in collections of heritage tomatoes.
I was going to say,
so
we all...
It took a long time for mainstream ingredients to actually permeate.
Yes, we pay a premium price for those yellow tomatoes now at the farmer's market. So, another thing that struck me as I was reading through the book is at first the people you were writing about were primarily men. They were the ones who were writing things down. And then as the book goes on, you write about Catherine de' Medici in the late 1500s, Lady Fetteplace in the 1600s, Hannah Woolley, who was the first acknowledged female author of a cookbook in the late 1600s, all the way up to Fanny Farmer, World War II home economist,
Beck Bertol and Child in the 60s and Francis Moore LaPay and Alice Waters in the 70s through today. So a lot of prominent men published cookbooks and were gastronomes, but then women became involved outside the kitchen by publishing books, and not just cookbooks, but home economics type books too, and changing the way people saw food. How did this shift happen? When did women really start to become a little more prominent in terms of being able to write about the culinary arts and getting it published or taken seriously?
Well, I think it matches the same time that women generally became a more prominent part of society and not sort of locked away. And the history of the world is a sexist history until relatively recently, and it's the same for the history of food. And women were publishing books early in history, but men would often steal those books and then republish them as their own because they said that the women wouldn't be taken seriously. So it takes a while for women to become taken seriously. I think really it's not until the 1700s when some of those characters you've just mentioned start becoming prominent. But it didn't even stop other men from stealing those works. And this is a great feature across time of men stealing the recipes of women and passing them off as their own work. But then women get hold of the subject and run with it. And as you've just rightly said, you know, all those amazing characters from Alice Waters to Frances Moore LaPay, who was this amazingly brave woman in Berkeley, California, who warned that we were eating too much meat, and she advocated the vegetarian diet, which was heresy in those days because, of course, Americans eating meat was a way of expressing their freedom and expressing the fact that they had lots of produce that was accessible. But as she says now, what was then heresy has now become common knowledge. So it took a while for women to be taken seriously in the food world, but I think, you know, once it took hold, they never looked back.
You're listening to a pre-recorded episode of Focus. I'm Lisa Braltz, and I'm talking this hour with William Sitwell, author of The History of Food in 100 Recipes. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll talk more about his new book and one recipe he discovered while researching the book that is, for lack of a better word, disgusting. Stay with us. This is Focus on WILL. We'll be right back. We're back on Focus on WILL AM 580. I'm Lisa Braltz. You're listening to a pre-recorded edition of Focus. We aren't taking live calls this hour, but you can comment about the show on Facebook and Twitter at Focus 580. This hour, I'm talking with William Sitwell. He's the author of The History of Food in 100 Recipes.
So if you had to choose, what were some of your favorite discoveries while researching and writing this book?
Well, I think one of my favorite discoveries was learning about a man called Clarence Saunders, who was an early proponent of what we see as modern retail in the U.S. He was a man who came from a very poor family but found his métier in the grocery trade, and he opened a little store. And he was traveling back from Indiana one day trying to work out how he could deal with the economic inefficiencies of his business at that time. The way that it would work is you would go to his store, you'd queue up, men in white coats would hand you food from the shelves, and then you'd go home. So people were rushed off their feet at lunchtime to start, and then they had nothing to do the rest of the day. And he was on a train trying to think about what was he going to do to fix this problem. His train slowed down. He looked out of the window. He was going past a pig farm, and he saw a mother sow feeding her 8 piglets. And the idea struck him, self-service. And 3 months later, he opened the first Piggly Wiggly in honor of his great moment of piggy inspiration. And Piggly Wiggly went on to make him absolutely, you know, millions of pounds, which he then lost. He went bankrupt at the time of the Second World War. And also, he broke a few New York Stock Exchange rules when he tried to buy all his stock back. And he went bankrupt and was unable to trade under his own name. So he set up a new business and a new store, which he called Clarence Saunders, Sole Owner of My Name Stores, which shows you quite how angry he was that he couldn't use his own name. That didn't go very well. And then he had a couple more inventions. He invented a thing called Cadoozle, which he says was a store of the future, where basically you stood outside a shop and you put your money through a slot, and you put a coin in the slot, and a hand would pick up the food and put it onto a conveyor belt and deliver it to the windows, sort of little panel door. But that didn't work because the stuff kept on breaking down. And then on his deathbed, he invented a thing called Food Electric. And his concept was, everyone dismissed it at the time, the idea of food having packaging on it that a machine could read, and then you put your money into the machine and left. And, of course, that's how so many of us now shop. So he is one of my great heroes. There is a guy called Dennis Papa, who used to work for the Irish physicist Robert Boyle, who experimented with a thing he called the steam digester, or engine for softening bones. And basically, this was he invented the first pressure cooker. And he felt that this pressure cooker would enable the poor to be more economic because it meant that they could cook old cuts of meat and make them softer. He said that this machine could make alcohol that wouldn't give you a hangover. And he produced this wonderful book that I saw in the British Library full of amazing illustrations, painstaking research, every experiment written down in great detail. It's a very emotional thing to read because actually he was ignored by his peers. He presented his findings to the Royal Society. They said this will never catch on. And he died a pauper. And about 10 years after his death, someone found his designs, patented them, and made a fortune. So there are these characters that stand out to me as being people who we should think about when we shop and eat today, because they have these amazing stories, and they really help move the story of food along.
Did you find anything during your research that appalled you or horrified you or shocked you or grossed you out or was distasteful to you as you were putting it together, but you felt you had to include it in the book?
There is a recipe that William Kitchener records in his wonderful book, The Cook's Oracle. And he records a recipe that he discovered from 1660, from a Mr. Mizzles. We don't know who that was. And it's a recipe for how to roast and eat a goose alive. And the recipe first calls for a lively creature, which you then pluck and baste in lard and butter while still alive. And then you set it on the ground next to sort of cups of water which are infused with honey, and other cups are infused, have sort of slices of apple with them. And then you draw a circle of fire around the goose. So the goose starts darting around, trying to avoid the flames, and in between takes sips of the water, which then infuses it with a sort of like a marinade. And then the recipe reads, "When you see her giddy with running and begin to stumble, she is roasted enough. Take her up, set her before your guests, and she will cry as you cut off any part of her, and will almost be eaten up before she be dead. It is mighty pleasant to behold." Well, I'm sure that I'd want to see that take place at my kitchen table.
Were there feathers still on the bird?
No, I think they say you need to you pluck her first. So you pluck her alive, and then you baste her in lard.
Okay, that's terrifying. So, okay, so we've discussed, just briefly, we touched on the fact that the cyclical nature of history, and then, of course, the history of food. And one of the things that I think makes the book so entertaining and accessible is how history that you talk about relates to current events in food. And there are so many examples, and I have a few that I'd like you to talk about. And the first one I want to talk about is food hipsters, foodies, food nerds, food snobs. Archestratus, I hope I'm saying his name right, in 350 BC said, "You may as well be buried measureless fathoms underground if you can't get a certain type of honey."
That's right. He was a foodie obsessive. And like a lot of chefs today, he was completely obsessed with where you should get the best ingredients. And if you read the chapter I've written about him, and this is from 350 BC, this was a man who traveled around Asia Minor trying to get his hands on as good a food to eat as he possibly could. And then he wrote all of his experiences down in a poem called Life of Luxury, which he wrote in ancient Greek hexameters, of which there are only sort of fragments that still exist. But there are enough fragments that you can put together a pretty clear picture of what he was like. And he writes about the fact that he hates boiled chickpeas, beans, apples, and dried figs. He says that when it comes to buying the best ingredients, he says, "Let it come from Byzantium if you want the best." He talks about where you must get the best honey. He talks about if you want to get fish, where you must get it from. He is as obsessed about where to get good ingredients from as the best chefs are today. So there's nothing new in that.
Informative, but a little snobby, I think. Maybe a little bit.
Sure. You know, that's the foodies for you.
Another current-day food idea that has its roots in history, per your book, is food as health-providing or health-depleting, depending on the current wisdom of the day. A couple of examples: sugar is good for you, or potatoes cause leprosy.
Yeah, again, you know, I think that if you spend your life trying to live according to the latest health advice, you'd get completely mad. And nothing has changed today, you know, from is sugar good, which, you know, sugar good, sugar bad, red wine good, red wine bad. You know, fat good, fat bad, which fats are good, which fats are bad. And people have been dishing out dodgy advice for centuries. And the only mantra has to be common sense. And if you know where food comes from, it's probably better for you. If you know the farmer, it's probably better for you. That's a sort of Alice Waters straightforward point of view. And food could simply has to be is the best. So, the advice that's given around food and health goes around in circles. But I think you just have to rely on what you think sounds more sensible.
I think it changes all the time. I think even some advice we received 5 years about food is different now in terms of what's healthy or what isn't. Or they find a new food that has, up until now, we had no idea that it had certain health properties. So it sounds like it goes way back where a certain type of food was touted as being good for you, kind of like smoking. You know, sugar's good for you. Smoking's great for you. 4 out of 5 doctors smoke Chesterfield cigarettes or whatever. So it's sort of the same thing. Food.
Yeah, there's a chapter in my book all about honey and about how honey was fated as being a sort of, you know, magical ingredient. And I think again today people still rave about honey, and honey was very much sort of viewed as, you know, the food of the gods, and there was a god, I think, himself, devoted to honey. And I think that what's interesting is that, honey is one of those things that has mesmerized people throughout history.
You also talk a little bit about food tourism. The earliest event of food tourism that I've ever heard of, a gentleman named Pantaleon goes out into Europe to research cheese for his sponsor, Ludovico, around 1450, and he writes a book about it. Can you talk a little bit about his trip and his love of cheese?
Well, what's amazing about Pantaleone's book is that it's the first book ever written that celebrates a single ingredient. And it was published in 1477, and it was called Summa Lacticinorum. And what's amazing is that it tells you how important this guy thought about cheese, because the word Summa, S-U-M-M-A, and many people just call that book Summa. There was a previous book called Summa, written by Thomas Aquinas, and it was a compendium of theology, and it was basically viewed as the most important book ever about sort of the philosophy and man's existence on the planet. So what I find amusing is that there's one Summa, which is all about man, woman's very existence. And then there's another book called Summa, which is all about cheese. So that gives you the idea of how important Pantaleone thought cheese was. And he believed in the health-giving qualities of cheese. And he despaired of a time when he wouldn't be able to eat cheese. Because he wrote in his book, "I grieve at the thought of living in an era when I, a great eater of cheese, should refrain." He couldn't bear the idea of living without cheese. So he traveled throughout Europe, and he produced this book written in Latin, which I saw a copy in the British Library. And it details very precisely all the markets he visits from Amsterdam to Paris to London, where he tastes every different kind of cheese. And it's an absolutely fascinating book, because it just tells you how developed cheesemaking was in the 15th century, and how many different varieties there were at the time. And so I also tell the story about, I muse on how cheese would have been invented. Probably some Arab nomad jogging through the desert one warm, sunny day, and he's got some milk in a container made of, the container's made of animal stomach, and the milk in his container reacts to the rennet in the stomach lining. The milk curdles. And then when our nomad stops for a swig of milk, he finds that there are white lumps in the mixture, which, of course, are curds. And it may not refresh him, but he likes the taste, and cheese is born.
Which is really another form of food preservation or milk preservation, makes it last longer.
Absolutely, because it was originally milk, dairy cattle were more seasonal. So you had to work out a way of getting your lactose in the time when you had no milk available, so you convert it to cheese.
You mentioned when you were talking about Cortez and Montezuma meeting and chocolate, the chapter is about hot chocolate and his introduction to that. But you also, you talk about, it was a slave culture there, obviously, and you spoke a little bit about the poor treatment of the people who were producing producing the chocolate and other exotic foods. It was the poor producing the food for the rich. And you touch a little bit on how, then as now, it's still happening now. Do you feel this is something we have a better or worse handle on now in terms of where our food comes from and how it arrives to us and who is doing the heavy lifting balanced with who the recipients are, who the eaters are?
Well, I think we live in a complicated world where half the world is obsessed about where its food comes from and is interested, or maybe not half the world, maybe a quarter of the world, or maybe just the foodies, are obsessed about where their food comes from and are passionate about making sure that they buy their food from sustainable sources and that the welfare for both the people who produced it and the welfare for the planet is respected. But then you've got the other vast proportion of the world's population who just need to have cheap food for fuel and can rely on fast food outlets to satisfy that need. But of course, cheap food means cheap welfare, means cheap environmental practice. And it's very hard to argue, if you haven't got very much money and you need to feed your family, it's very hard to argue against buying food from somewhere where it produces it very, very cheaply. So, we may be a highly developed culture, but it doesn't mean that we've necessarily moved on. And there's a lot of farming practice that is terrible. There's still lots of very poor treatment of animals. But I think that there is a growing number of people who realize that actually the health benefits of buying food locally, seasonally, I think it was Alice Waters who said that you either pay now or you pay later. And if you're prepared to pay now, you will realize that you can invest in food that tastes nice and you can get a better experience, or you pay later, which means the environment suffers and potentially your health suffers. So I think it's a question of not necessarily, I think education is too formal a word. I think it's a question of trying to inspire people to see that, if you really think about and care about your food, you'll get a much greater enjoyment out of it. And actually, if you can teach your children to appreciate food, that the health benefits are untold. I mean, the cost for the state, for the governments around the world in trying to treat obesity is so immense that governments should be supporting the idea of feeding children. I mean, Alice Waters' great campaign at the moment is to try and persuade schools to provide free breakfast and free lunch for kids, and buy food directly from farmers, and to have philanthropists as the middleman, not making money out of the shift of food from farm to plate. And I think that, there's a great argument for that, because if you feed children well, if you enthuse children about food, about how wonderful food is, and you teach children through food, what better way to teach math than, adding up cupcakes? And it's a really great way of engaging children and getting them to engage in how you grow and nurture food, that the payback inevitably is far greater.
Well, and Alice Waters has the Edible Schoolyard program. I think that came from her, and that was not just connecting kids to food, but also to growing food and being more connected with its origins, as opposed to saying, hey, carrots come from the grocery store. It's more like carrots actually grow underneath the ground, and I think she's really inspired a lot of activity in this country anyway.
That's right. The Edible Schoolyard is the most amazing project because it encourages children to plant seeds and watch things grow. And anyone who has kids knows that, not just having kids, if you sow seeds, you watch plants grow, it's really exciting. There's nothing tastes better than your own homegrown food. And it may be psychological, it may be physiological, it may be absolutely fact, but you certainly engage in it, and children can engage with it if they are planting their own seeds. Because it's just really exciting, and it's it's enjoyable and it's healthy.
And I found from personal experience with my own children that they will tend to want to eat something they had a hand in growing themselves.
Absolutely, exactly.
So I'm going to move us toward the end here a little bit. In the book, you mentioned the writer Carlo Petrini, who helped found the slow food movement back in 1986, and that movement encouraged and still does encourage people to get away from microwaves and processed food and fast food and return to growing and cooking food themselves. But he didn't like to cook. Is cooking something that you enjoy?
I love cooking. I love cooking. I wish I could spend
more
time cooking. I should probably spend more time cooking, less time talking about it and writing about it. But I love it. I think there's no greater pleasure than cooking for friends. you know, sharing your enthusiasm by having friends over cooking for them, it's a great gift, isn't it, to share food? It's where peace and harmony, I think, around the world starts, around the table, when you bring people together. And so I love to cook, and I need to try and practice what I preach, cook more often.
Now, I saw a video of you, it was an hour-long video that you hosted about the pursuit of Michelin stars, and you ended up in a kitchen. How did you function in that kind of environment?
Well, it was tough. I mean, my mission for that film was to investigate the power and the influence of the Michelin stars and to work out why it was that so many chefs are obsessed to get stars and whether it was a valid form of recognition, because chefs sort of sacrifice themselves on the altar of Michelin. And I wanted to find out about how valid this was. Who were the people judging them? Who were the mysterious characters judging these restaurants in secret? And part of the film sees me in the kitchen of a 2-star restaurant, Marcus Waring at the Barclay in London's Knightsbridge area, chopping some shallots as the lunchtime service begins, and seeing the amazing discipline, seeing the intense pressure that goes into producing beautiful plates of food. And I have a go at assembling a particular dish, but the chef just throws it in the bin. He said I put too much pepper on it. And he was quite right too, I think.
I think in one part you said, I'm not throwing this away, and you started eating it.
Yeah. Well, he tries to throw it away. He shouts to his junior sous chef, he says, throw this in the bin. And I say, hey, man, you can't throw that in the bin. I want to eat that. So I scoff it up, and it's fine. But I said, is this not a 2-star dish? He said, it's a 2-star dish. You just did it wrong. So I experienced a little bit of the harsh treatment, the harsh environment that working in that sort of level of pressure, what it's like. I think I describe it as being a bit like that the film Saving Private Ryan, when the troops are arriving at Omaha Beach. There's massive sort of nerves going on. They're about to sort of be hit by a wave of bullets when the front doors of the boat go down and they have to run into the sea. And so it was a bit like that in that, okay, they weren't being shot at, but there was this amazing rising tension just as service begins. Before everything starts being, you know, cooking, there were all the guys in there and a few girls too. You could feel the nerves and the adrenaline start to race as the bow doors of the kitchen were about to go down and they had to start serving out this amazing food. So it was an exciting thing to do.
But you probably prefer the home kitchen environment?
I'd rather sit in a restaurant and eat food than have to cook it.
How has food blogging and the internet changed the way people pass along their knowledge about food? Do you see any problems with the speed at which we're exchanging that information, or is it all good? Is this better?
Well, I think what's great is the internet has sort of democratized restaurant criticism and allowed anyone to write about it. It's not just the domain of the restaurant critics who rule over the city's food pages with an iron rod, and I think the food bloggers can pierce the pomposity of some of the most respected food critics because they can just write what they feel and they're real people. I think the problem is that sometimes food bloggers, I like to read the views of restaurant critics. I like to read the views of the professionals, people who write really well. But that's not to say there aren't some good bloggers as well. I think sometimes there's so much, it's such a cacophony of noise. There's so many bloggers, it's hard to know who the good ones are. We highlight some of the best each month in the magazine I edit in the UK in order to try and help people through the sort of forest of confusion. But it does mean that people can engage with food and write about it and share it with their friends. And I think that's great. I don't particularly like seeing people sitting photographing their food the whole time and, you know, no conversation. They just spend their time tweeting about what they're eating. But I think that if it engages people more, the food blogging community is one of the biggest sort of community of bloggers, as far as I can tell. And I think that it keeps chefs on their toes. They don't have to just perform when the restaurant critics are there. They never know. There might be a blogger in the room. So I think that it's opened up the whole world of food and has increased the discussions that we have about food. And I think that the more people can have access to great restaurants, the more people can talk about food and eat wonderfully. That's great. And I think food blogging has enabled that. It's just a question of, you know, you got to find the bloggers that you like and find the bloggers that you trust.
Okay, for my last question, sort of related. So let's say a descendant of yours is writing a similar book to the one that you just published a couple hundred years from now, what or whom from our current day, for good or for ill, would be included in that book, do you think?
That is an amazing question that no one's asked, and it's a really tough one. Who knows? I imagine that in the same way that food goes in cycles, that quite a lot of the recipes in here will still remain valid. There are bound to be new technologies that change things, move things on. I don't see why meat fruit, Heston Blumenthal's amazing creation that he serves in his restaurant dinner in London, I think that'll be there. It's a wonderful dish where it pretends to be fruit, but actually it's chicken liver parfait dipped in a mandarin jelly, so it looks like a mandarin. That, I think, will stand the test of time. I think that the writings of Archestratus will stand the test of time. You can't avoid ancient Egyptian flatbreads because that's where the story starts. I think, funny enough, that quite a lot of the recipes from the 20th century will stay because the 20th century saw such a revolution in the way that we cook, shop, and eat that you can't ignore that. But I don't know. Let's talk again in 100 years.
Sounds great. I wish we had more time, but that will do it for us today. William Sitwell, thank you so much for your time today on Focus. It was a wonderful conversation.
Thanks. It's been a really great pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
I'm Lisa Braltz, and you've been listening to Focus this hour on WILL AM 580. I talked with William Sitwell this hour. He's the author of the new book, The History of Food in 100 Recipes. To find out more about him and his book, visit our website, will.illinois.edu/focus. Tomorrow on the show, we'll be back live. Host Jim Meadows talks with Douglas Nelson. He's president of Bodyworks Associates in Champaign. We'll talk with him about neuromuscular therapy and his new book, The Mystery of Pain.